So I want to share a little sutta with you all and use it as an opportunity to discuss some of the sort of best things in life, I guess I would say. This is in the Anguttara Nikaya, sutta number 7. It's in the Book of Sevens, number 6. And the title, this is Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation, as you can probably tell. And the title is Wealth in Detail. And the reason it's in detail is because the sutta just before it is Wealth in Brief. And it just gives the list of these 7 treasures. And sometimes when people talk about it, they use that translation, 7 treasures. So here the Buddha is saying there are these 7 kinds of wealth. The wealth of faith, the wealth of virtuous behavior, the wealth of, now this is Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation, moral shame. And then the next one is the wealth of moral dread. And I'll talk about those. Bhikkhu Bodhi was just visiting us this last week, and we actually had a part of our conversation was about these 2 qualities. And we also talked a bit about this at Sutta Study on Wednesday. So some of you already have the preview on that. And then the next one is the wealth of learning, and then the wealth of generosity, and the wealth of wisdom. Like, to have these 7 treasures in our life is so powerful, so beautiful, so stabilizing. So I guess I would say encouraging. It brings confidence. We are having, with these 7 treasures, we live a happy life here and now, and we are confident of how things come together in the future. So the Buddha didn't say that here, but that's something we can observe for ourselves and also gather from other teachings that the Buddha gave about how much, you know, how do we really live a beautiful life? And this is, you know, this is one way to frame it, to see, like, how are these 7 treasures showing up in my life? And how might I bring them more to fulfillment? So because this sutta is in detail, it gives a description of what each of these means. And that's important because sometimes the Buddha will define these qualities a little bit differently in different cases, depending on who he's speaking to and what the context is. So in this case, the Buddha talks, he defines the wealth of faith by saying that a noble disciple places faith in the enlightenment of the Tathagata. And then he talks about the Blessed One being an arahant, being fully accomplished, knowing the worlds, that usual, that stock sort of paragraph that we chant frequently of the Buddha's qualities. That the Buddha is the enlightened one, the blessed one. So this is what we call the wealth of faith. Now, of course, in other places, when the Buddha talks about faith, he'll also talk about the faith in the Dhamma, the faith in the enlightened Sangha. But here, he just talks about the faith in the enlightenment of the Tathagata. And I think it's interesting when the Buddha refers to himself as the Tathagata. It's like, it's so impersonal. It's not about him at all. It's like the Tathagata is this phenomenon, really, of this enlightened, fully enlightened Buddha. And, you know, that this is something that happens from time to time in the world, that someone, when there's no description of Dhamma, the Dhamma will always be there, but the whole world can forget. It's come to a point where there's no clarity around what the Dhamma is anymore. And then someone arises, someone is born into the world who has the karma to discover it again. And the Buddha talked about this. I think it's really helpful to remember, and those of you who come often to these teachings have heard this before, but it's important to remember that the Buddha didn't make up a philosophy. He wasn't trying to, you know, come up with some way of describing what happens. He discovered it. He said it was like, it's like finding an overgrown path and moving your way through it and coming to this abandoned ancient city and discovering it. It's like it already exists. That's the way he at one point describes the discovery of the Dhamma. And to really see it so clearly as he did on the night of his enlightenment, that he could distill, and he had the ability to distill it into a way of describing it that we could understand it, which is so amazing. What a gift that is. And so when we think about faith in Buddhism, and it is at, you know, partially seeing something, partially accepting it, and then exploring it. And the Buddha never wanted us to just accept things blindly. So it's not a blind faith, and it's not the goal of Buddhism to have faith. The goal of Buddhism is to know for ourselves the whole thing, full awakening. And the faith helps us get there before we see it completely for ourselves. That we have enough confidence in the awakened mind or in the Buddha, if you will. I mean, as some people say, you know, I don't want to bow to a person. I don't want to bow to the, you know, Shakyamuni Buddha, the Siddhartha Gautama. But we can pay respects to that awakened mind, that this is what is possible for us also. The Buddha said that arahants have the same awakening as the Buddha, and the same knowledge, but the difference that we see in the scriptures and the suttas is that the Buddha finds it without anyone being able to point the way. He had to really make his way through all that brush and bramble and overgrown path to find it. So this is something that I know I feel incredibly grateful for. I feel incredibly grateful that the Buddha taught for 45 years, and we have so much of his teachings recorded and passed down and quite a pristine sort of volume, you might say, pristine rendering, because it's like this is what we can base our own practice on, and then we can see for ourselves. So powerful. So that first wealth of faith is like that. And then the second one, virtuous behavior, and here the Buddha describes it as the noble disciple abstaining abstaining from the destruction of life, abstaining from taking what is not given, abstaining from sexual misconduct, abstaining from false speech, abstaining from liquor, wine, and intoxicants, the basis for heedlessness. Now, I discovered something interesting in looking at this sutta, because in Bhante Sujato's translation, he also includes, when it comes to speech, after saying abstaining from lying, he includes abstaining from divisive speech, harmful speech, and frivolous speech. And you can say, well, how is that possible? Don't you just look at the Pali and see whether or not those other aspects of right speech are there or not? But actually, the Pali itself has ellipses. So I suspect that the reason Bhikkhu Bodhi only has the false speech represented is because this is obviously part of the five, this is the five precepts. But that ellipses, that dot, dot, dot in the Pali itself leaves open, like, where do you take the previous text from in the suttas? So you're, it's saying, and this happens a lot in the Pali, and it's like, it's got the dot, 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 these ellipses referring back to a previous section where it's completely there. And then I'm thinking that Bodhisujato is pulling from a different place where the Buddha uses this same collection of things, and it has the other parts of right speech included. And of course, for our purposes, the wealth of virtuous behavior is going to include all the aspects of right speech. All right, let's say you're a little wealthier if you include those other three parts, I think. So this is, you know, we can think, oh, well, I've heard this 100 times before. Yeah, this is what virtuous behavior means. But then, you know, it's really important that we ourselves, I think, look for examples in our life and look for examples that we hear about where people are keeping the precepts, maybe even in an exemplary way. So this weekend is Memorial Weekend here in the U.S. And the reverence or the respect, the gratitude that people have for those who have, quote unquote, served the country in protecting it in the military, particularly. You know, when I was a child growing up in the Midwest, we'd have Memorial Day parades sometimes, or we'd have these meetings at the American Legion Hall where there's a ceremony and raising a flag and that kind of thing. And, you know, this intended to be a time when you reflect on some of the sacrifice that people have made for the protection of the country. Now, as a Buddhist, of course, I'd abstain from killing any living being. And the Buddha said, you know, we shouldn't just do these precepts ourselves, but also encourage others to abstain from killing any living being. And, you know, speak in praise of not killing any living being. And so there's this reflection on how we relate to something like people serving in the military and serving, because we also have compassion, gratitude for the courage that people have, gratitude for, you know, what people are trying to do, even if there's this collision with moral virtue. And there's this story that we came across this weekend. The three of us have been talking about it. This man named Desmond Doss. He was a young man at the time of World War II. And he decided, he worked at a shipyard, so building ships. And he could have avoided getting drafted into the active military because of his work as a shipbuilder. But he decided he wanted to go into the active military, but he was a very devout Christian, and he determined that he would never carry a gun. And so he became a medic, and he actually saved many, many, many soldiers. Like, and the estimate is like 75 to 100 soldiers. He would run out on the field and take them and treat them. And there was a point in the Battle of Okinawa.
I think so. Yeah. I mean, there was against the Japanese.
Right. I think it was Okinawa. Anyway, they think that he saved right there 75 soldiers, and some of them were Japanese. And he was incredibly courageous and had this determination to not kill. And so, you know, there's the reality in this world of this dark and light kama. And it's our decision where we want to stand for ourselves. And we can still have compassion for the goodness in others, regardless of where they stand. So just some thoughts on precepts and looking at the examples that help us reflect more carefully on our own views and our own precepts, and help us to really increase our purity, which is the wealth, to have this, you know, real wealth, this treasure of virtuous behavior running through all of our actions, our speech, and even our thinking, because it's our thoughts that are the seed for all of our speech and action. And then these two, the wealth of moral shame and the wealth of moral dread. When we were talking with Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi, we were talking about the difference in translations. So in Bhante Sujato, for these two words, hiri in Pali, translated here by Bhikkhu Bodhi as moral shame, is translated as conscience by Bhante Sujato. And moral dread is translated as prudence by Bhante Sujato. Excuse me. And so we had a discussion with Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi, and he also is like, yeah, people don't relate to that idea of shame so well. You know, it carries that heaviness of self-recrimination, which is not the intention of these terms, I think. The Buddha talked about these two as the guardians of the earth, that these two, like, you know, really, one thing that Bhikkhu Bodhi said that I thought was important when we talked with him is that both of these are about the present moment. Sometimes I've heard the moral shame or conscience referring to what we've done in the past. And he says it's not in the intention in hiri, it's about the present. You know, that not wanting to do something that actually degrades our character. That we, you know, as we are in this present moment, we have that conscience around, it might be something we just did, but it's around the reflection on what we did right here in the present moment. And also, excuse me, not wanting to have, to do things, say things, put energy into thinking things that will actually bring our purity of mind, our purity of action, our character down, degraded. We think this is beneath me. This doesn't come from kind of a sense of personal pride. It comes from an appreciation of the importance of living purely and how we impact others, because that's where we make most of our kama. It's with other people. We impact one another. And so this idea, hiri, this conscience, this wanting to take care, to not do things that are beneath our standard, and the standard being these precepts and the other qualities that come from practicing Dhamma. And then the prudence or the moral dread is considering the consequences of actions. We don't want the consequences of lying, for example, coming back to us in the future, or impacting other people. So these are these two guardians of the world. You know, when we have that sense of conscience and we have that sense of I want to take care to not set off a reaction that comes back to us in a harmful way or to others, that's really the beauty and the power of these two qualities, these treasures. So as a treasure, you can see how it's not about shaming. It's not about this kind of unproductive regret. It's really about what lifts us up and what makes our own lives and the world a better place. And then we have the wealth of learning. And of course, all of us here have had ample opportunity to learn in this world. You know, we have all kinds of systems in our various cultures to, you know, get university degrees or go to school or read a lot or investigate the internet, or, you know, we've got all kinds of avenues of learning. But the Buddha, of course, here is talking about learning and remembering and accumulating those teachings of Dhamma that are good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end, with the right meaning and phrasing. And what this means is that it's the meaning, it's got the right meaning that really is the way Dhamma works. And it's said in a way that really communicates that meaning of what the Dhamma is. Which proclaim perfectly the complete and pure spiritual life. So this is what the Dhamma, it really communicates the whole way of living according to Dhamma. And this is another thing that I just have, I'm in awe of how the Buddha could elucidate this complete path that covers every aspect of life, every aspect, every phase, every situation. There's a way to apply the Dhamma. So he says that such teachings as these one has learned much of, retained in mind, recited verbally, mentally investigated, and penetrated well by view. So it's not just like, oh, I've memorized this sutta or something. That's part of it. But then to really, really think about it, really investigate, and really investigate how it applies in our life, in our experience, and taking the principles of Dhamma into the mind in meditation and allowing the deeper connection to Dhamma to occur, so that seeing it directly, having it really like reside in the heart, that direct knowing, that's when we really have an understanding. That's when we really can speak about Dhamma with a confidence and clarity. So that's certainly a treasure. And then the sixth one is the treasure of generosity. And the Buddha describes it here, and this is, all of this applies to lay life as well as to monastic life. And he says here, the noble disciple dwells at home with a heart devoid of the stain of miserliness, freely generous, open-handed, delighting in relinquishment, one devoted to charity, delighting in giving and sharing. This is the wealth or the treasure of generosity. And of course, we all have that experience of what it's like to freely give something. And generosity can come in so many different forms. So a couple days ago, I had an opportunity to help Aya Nandabodhi up in Spirit Rock. Aya Santachita became ill and couldn't be there for opening the retreat that they're teaching, and there are a lot of people, like 97, I think, attending the retreat right now, and about a quarter of them brand new to retreats, never having done it before, and quite a few people with significant life challenges. And I think, you know, it's the only retreat they give each year that is based on Dana. So, you know, people can come to this retreat that can't afford to come otherwise. And Ayananda Bodhi wrote to me, it was kind of late at night, on Wednesday, I guess it was, and asked if there was any possibility that I could step in a little bit. So I went there on Thursday and spent the day offering teachings and counseling. And it was just so, it's just such a joy if you find yourself in a situation where your whole role is to support what's happening. And, you know, so I didn't have any primary responsibility, but I could just fill in and support wherever was needed. And it's like, it's possible to get into this mental state where you're just giving and there's nothing else that's needed. There's a kind of mindfulness that can arise. People have talked about this when they're taking care of someone. Like I remember one woman who was attending one of our teachings, and she talked about her mind becoming very still as she was taking care of this elderly person. She was a caregiver, but she had kind of graduated to, if that's how it feels, I'm not sure, but she was managing caregivers at that point in her career. And one of the people who usually worked for that agency wasn't able to come in. So she herself went to take care of this elder person. And she said, it was just such a beautiful experience for her because she was completely settled in just being there to do one thing after another in care of this person. And there's a mindfulness that can come and a stillness that can come in the mind. And so this is one way to be generous. You know, it's not always about materiality. It's also about our material things. It's also about, you know, how we can at the right time just be in service. And I say the right time because, you know, sometimes we are conditioned to be the servant all the time. And that's not appropriate to, I think can be inappropriate to a blossoming, developing path for ourselves. So we have to always be looking at context, you know, what's best for others, what's best for ourselves, and hold those in balance. But just to kind of like, again, look at this afresh, if we can, to see, you know, where is generosity in my life, in my own practice, and how might I, you know, like round it out for each of these treasures. It's funny. It's like maybe we think of treasure as something that just comes to us if we're lucky, but that's not how the Buddha really taught. He taught about making choices, that we ourselves can look for ways that we increase the treasure in our life, these qualities, these beautiful actions and experiences. Okay, then we come to the last one, which is the treasure of wisdom. And he says, the noble disciple is wise. They possess the wisdom that discerns arising and passing away. So that's the definition of wisdom here. And other places we find a different definition, like maybe knowing the difference between skillful and unskillful qualities. But here it's the discernment of arising and passing away, which is noble and penetrative and leads to the complete destruction of suffering. And just to kind of unpack that sentence, you know, how do we know the arising and passing away to really see impermanence, to really realize that everything that comes through our senses arises and passes away? What is the penetration? What is the noble nature of that knowledge? It's that we see that there is nothing we can cling to, that nothing is worthy of being clung to, that we exist in this process of unfolding and collapsing. This is what happens constantly. And that there is no self. There is no core solidity that we can call me or mine. When we penetrate that completely, we don't want to cling to anything. It's all Teflon. And this is where the complete destruction of suffering occurs. No clinging, no suffering. And so that's the seventh treasure. So just, you know, just some thoughts about how we might explore these seven noble, beautiful treasures and increase the wealth in our life. There's a verse that is on the end here. It says, the wealth of faith, the wealth of virtuous behavior, the wealth of moral shame and moral dread, the wealth of learning and generosity with wisdom, the seventh kind of wealth. When one has these seven kinds of wealth, whether a woman or a man, they say that one is not poor, that one's life is not lived in vain. Therefore, an intelligent person, remembering the Buddha's teaching, should be intent on faith and virtuous behavior, confidence and vision of the Dhamma. So, thank you for listening. I'd like to hear what any of you might be thinking about this. And any questions you might have. Anybody in the room want to say anything? They look pretty content over here.
About the generosity, Aya.
Yes.
I was thinking there was a phase in my life where I would go in the mall, I do shopping, and that would give me happiness. And now the time is where I keep thinking, how can I give?
Oh, yeah.
And that gives me joy. And that's actually lasts so much longer than the pleasure I got from buying stuff in the mall.
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Thank you, Nita. Could you hear Nita okay? You couldn't hear Nita? Oh, some of them could, some of them couldn't. So Nita was saying that there was a time in her life when she'd go to the mall and go shopping and she would get pleasure from buying things. She said now she's come to a time in her life when what she thinks about is how she can give, and that gives her so much pleasure, and much more pleasure than ever came from buying things. And I think a lot of us can relate to that. Did I repeat that pretty? Yeah, that's okay. Yeah. Yes, Virginia. No, Vandana. Sorry, I can't read the names very well. I'm going to have to get some new glasses. Vandana.
Thank you, Aya, for such a beautiful teaching. And when I first came in Buddhism, and I was, when I used to hear about faith, right, for me the previous experiences was that growing up, okay, you need to have faith in the God, or you need to have a faith in parents, you need to have whatever they're saying, you need to have faith in your teachers, right? But it was not clicking, that it was not connecting with the heart, because I never thought that faith can be blindly, just you blindly follow anyone, no matter who it is. And then slowly I was curious why people are saying you need to have faith in Buddha's teaching, you need to have faith. And I still experiment, because it has to be experimented, right? Nothing should be just taken with the blind faith. It's not going to last. Like my previous religious belief didn't last because of the just faith. They told me, no, you don't have to ask questions, just and just have faith in it, right? Maybe they had reasons, but never given the reason proper way. So you can cultivate the faith. I think the faith needs to be cultivated slowly, gradually, mm-hmm. by experimenting whatever we hear. So yeah, but you need to stick to it. You can't just reject without experimenting. So yeah, that's my own experience, that when I started experimenting on a daily basis, whatever the teachings are about the suffering, the causes of suffering, and then how your mind creates the narratives, all that is just coming right in that, yeah, this is true. That needs to be instilled. If something like for the moral shame, and the topic we discussed. So yesterday I was grading a paper because right now the final exams and the students have to write lesson plans for students, for their young children, because my students are teachers. So one of them have written a paper lesson plan to teach children empathy. And for that, she created a lesson plan that children should be feeling ashamed of themselves if they are hurting, if they're saying mean words or they're hurting somebody's feelings. But for my feedback for her was that we all make mistakes, and children are entitled to make mistakes. But at the same time, we have to provide the positive guidance to them that how can they develop deep empathy so they are not going in that route. But for that, we have to be very sensitive. We cannot scare children. We cannot make them afraid of saying something unless we know that it's not going to harm them, because we have diversity of people around, very sensitive people, children with special needs, and we can't put the shame in their hearts. So for me, again, I'm going to experiment with this, what Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation of moral shame. And I request your more guidance, maybe some other time, not today. Thank you.
A couple of things. One point that's really important that the Buddha had in a sutta, I just recently read it, but I can't come up with the reference, but he says, don't put your faith in the person. So don't put your faith in the teacher. Don't put your faith in, you know, the parent, because we make mistakes. And there's always that chance. He says, if you put the faith in the person, then what if that, you know, like if it's a monastic, what if they disrobe? You know, I've seen this so many times when people become disillusioned because they've put the faith in the teacher or the person. The Buddha says you have to put the faith in the Dhamma. And when he talks about himself as the Tathagata, it's really that impersonal, you know, you're putting your faith in the awakened mind. You're putting a faith in what the Buddha discovered and how he offered it to us. But you're not putting faith in, like we said, in a human being. And so this is very important for us practitioners. And then also this idea, I would drop the word shame entirely, like you're saying, Vandana. It's like making that conscious, you know, that idea that we really try to put ourselves in the position of the other person and just kind of practice, what does it feel like if I hear these words? And then, you know, how might I feel? You know, how can I really make that shift to appreciating what it might be like for them, and know that we can't fully know, have that humility. So I think those qualities, if your student teacher can get that across, wow, this is great. You know, because I think the word shame is just too triggering for any of us, really. And triggering that, because we have all this Western conditioning that overlays the teachings of the Buddha. And we have a lot of guilt. We have a lot of self-blame. We have a lot of blame for others in our culture. And we really want to be able to separate that from these beautiful qualities, which are protections and support for for being able to develop on the path. You can't really develop so well if we're just beating ourselves up. And we want it, we probably, these small children already probably have plenty of that in them already. You know, it's not easy to be trained, even as a small child. If people are telling us we're doing things wrong, it's not easy to be trained in a way that we have the self-dignity and forgiveness and acceptance of mistakes and ability to just acknowledge them, forgive ourselves, forgive others, and learn and go forward and do better. It's like that's what we want to really try to support. And this is a lifelong process. You know, it starts with you know, entering this world, but it goes on throughout. As long as we are still oppressed or hampered by this, I like Ajahn Sucitto's description of the inner tyrant, you know, or the, you know, this idea of putting ourselves down. This is really important to understand and let go of, and have the empathy for ourselves. So it's like people, someone recently said, you know, like, I feel guilty, and then I feel guilty for feeling guilty, and then I feel guilty for feeling guilty for feeling guilty, and it just never ends. You know, it's like, and so, you know, how do we interrupt that unhealthy process and begin to provide support for the heart to rise up out of that? Yeah, thank you. Ling?
Thank you, Arya. I've been thinking about what you're talking about, the wealth of learning. Sometimes I feel like I'm a bit overwhelmed by, you know, which one I should read. And I had this experience when I encountered the Dharma, like I mentioned, you know, from Ajahn, and then Arya came, I just bought all her books. I loved everything she said. I feel like I read a lot. I was so interested. But sometimes, and I feel like I don't really apply for the life, or I forgot. I sort of, I loved it so much, but doesn't sink in. So that's kind of, I don't know, is a problem or not a problem. Like, I'm reread her, another book. This one I loved. It said, Come and See Yourself. Mm-hmm. I read very slowly. But when I reread again, I feel like I haven't read before. I wonder if something I happened to everyone, or just me, I'm getting old.
No, it happens to everyone. And I'm really getting old by comparison to you. And I know that the brain doesn't work the way it used to work, but that's not what's important. It is true that we'll read those wonderful books once and we get certain things from it. And when we go back, it's the same with the suttas. We go back and read it again, then something else comes out, because we're in a different place and we're ready to hear different things and we see different things in it. And of course, we all forget. I mean, why do we have to meet every week? It's because we forget. There are things we don't know yet and we need to revisit that. And we also forget. And no wonder we forget of all the things that come into our life in the meantime, and all of the things we haven't, you know, resolved yet inside. So what you're experiencing is completely what we all experience. And it's good to not be hard on yourself and not think, oh, I have to learn all this and I have to learn all of that and it's so much. Don't think like that. Think, I'm opening my heart. I'm saying yes to what's good. And I'm going to keep saying yes every time the question comes. And as long as I do that, the right things will come into my experience. The book will fall open to the page you need. Just keep saying yes to practice, to these treasures.
Thank you.
You're welcome. It's James.
Hi. I think I can relate to what Ling says about reading things and not really sort of, I think she's saying about not feeling like you're taking them or anything. I mean, I sort of had that sort of fear, I guess, that I'm not absorbing it. But I think it's just a matter of just keeping on listening and keeping on reading, and you find it just sort of seeps into you gradually without you even realizing it. I mean, I'm sure my memory's pretty bad, and yet these things just keep coming to you because it's sort of a process of transformation, I guess. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I just want to say about the second, what said about generosity, is that certainly when I first started reading about these things, I always related to material things because I don't have a lot of material things to give, and not a lot of money. But I realised that you can be generous in lots of tiny little ways during the course of your day. And like with me working in a shop, that you often have people in or just want to chat, really. And there's this temptation to think, oh, I really should be off working or doing this. And I have to sort of stop myself from like trying to get back to the work, and just being generous with my time sometimes is I think people appreciate it. It does a lot of good. Yeah, definitely. It's not all about money in the bank, is it?
That's for sure.
But I just want to ask about the wisdom, the wealth of wisdom, the knowing arising and passing away. I'm still really, really fuzzy on things like that because I tend to just concern myself with just sort of the, I don't know, earlier stage, I suppose, sort of faith, virtue, and good behavior. But that just sounds so mysterious to me, you know. I mean, I kind of feel like concepts like that are probably way in the future for me, and I've got a lot of work to do before they'll really make sense. But I don't know whether there's any way you can enlarge on that that might give me some kind of...
I think letting go of the idea that it's way in the future, go back to the monk with the cloth. You know, there was a rising and passing away right there. And you just have to see it in one place. You don't have to think, oh, it's far away. It's right here. It's right here with us. And it's okay to, it's okay. No, it's amazing and wonderful to be focused on the development of faith and generosity and, you know, being a good person and virtue. You know, it's like, that's the basis. We're not going to see into the reality of the Dhamma without those. So it's like, that's, we keep doing what we can do. And then we, you know, really stay open to seeing what's happening to our own body. You know, we don't have to go further. I have this friend who was a monk for quite a long time, and he's returned to lay life now. He was a friend of my son when my son was a monk. And one time I was visiting Thailand, and he said, you know, there's this effort and people who gain a lot of learning and all of that, but then you'll have someone, you know, raised in the village in the poorest part of Thailand, and they see a hair on their hand, and they become fully enlightened. They just, like, that's all. They just look at that, and you know, it all is revealed. You know, and it's like, yeah, it's like to not be too caught up in, you know, like all of this we have to do. Just this, keep that going. Those practices, and just let it happen.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. And Joyce?
Yeah. Hi. Would you mind just saying this briefly about the story of the monk with the cloth?
Oh, yeah. I think James could tell it better than I can at this point. What was his name again? Shula? Was it? What was his name, James? Do you remember the monk's name?
I found it hard to pronounce. Is it Kula Thanka? Or I'm really bad with Pali pronunciation, so.
Shula. Anyway, he was, his brother was a monk, and he became a monk. And he was so bad at memorizing the verses, like the Buddha encouraged memorizing passages of the Dhamma, and he just like couldn't memorize anything at all. And his brother got, he said, you're just hopeless. You should leave. I want you leave. And so he goes to outside, or goes to the gate of the monastery, and he's crying because he doesn't want to leave. He has so much faith in the Buddha and in the Dhamma, but, he's just like, feels like this hopeless case. And the Buddha comes along, and the Buddha asks him what's going on. And he said, I'm just so hopeless, and I can't memorize the teachings, and my brother has told me to leave. And the Buddha said, well, no, come in. And, here, I'm going to give you this. He gave him a foot wiping cloth, white foot wiping cloth. He said, just take this cloth and focus on it and reflect. I can't remember exactly how the Buddha said it, but it's reflect on the purity of this cloth. And so this monk went, and he's just holding the cloth, and he's rubbing the cloth, and he sees that from his hands it starts to get dark, it starts to get stained, and just by doing that, the whole Dhamma opens up to him, and he sees the whole truth, and he immediately is endowed with these incredible psychic powers. And so at that time, and you can find the verses about this in the Theragatha. At that time, his brother was in charge of organizing the meal offerings, and someone was making a meal offering for the whole Sangha, for the Buddha and all of the monks. And this, his brother said, okay, this is for all of the monks except my brother, because I've sent him away. So all the monks go with the Buddha to the meal, and they're all at this person's house. And the Buddha notices that this brother is not there. And he refuses to give the blessing to start the meal. And he says, where is Chula? I'm sorry, I don't remember. Where is he? And then someone says, oh, he's back at the monastery. Or, well, in the meanwhile, our friend, the monk, Chula, he makes 1,000 copies of himself because he's got these psychic powers. He makes 1,000 copies of himself, and the commentary says they're all cleaning the monastery. I mean, he was rubbing the cloth, and he's focused on purity, and now he's got 1,000 copies of himself cleaning everything. And so the messenger who goes to find him can't figure out who Chula is. And he comes back and he says, there's 1,000 monks over there. They all look the same. I don't know which one to get. The Buddha says, okay, go back and just call his name and he'll come. So he does. And then Chula goes to the meal. And then the Buddha starts the meal. He waited until he arrived. And it's just such a beautiful, Chula Pantika. Yeah. Thank you. It's such a beautiful teaching about the compassion and patience, about, how we can feel really bad, but nothing's really wrong. And, you know, to see that there are many ways to practice, many ways to awaken. So thanks for asking, Joyce.
Thank you.
So if there's no more questions, if there is, go ahead. Anybody? No? Let's meditate. So we allow ourselves to turn inwards and just feel the quality of the heart, the mind. I like that citta means both heart and mind. And it kind of tells us that those heart qualities and the what we think of as intellect, it's all the same thing, really. And the wisdom is there. All of these treasures are there. We can settle into our posture and our breathing. We can just take the simple practice of noticing how our mind is right now, the state of the mind, the feeling in the heart. And wherever there is some kind of hindrance, you know, wanting something, wanting to get rid of something, laxness or dullness, restlessness or worry or doubt, that we can discover and apply our own methods for releasing those hindrances. Turning the mind to the faith that we have, to the generosity we have, to the virtue we have. We can gain confidence in our own conscience. Our own prudence. We can appreciate our own learning. It doesn't have to be vast, but we can let even a small, even what we might think of as small, be really deep. And what makes the learning really valuable is the wisdom, the treasure of wisdom. So we can just breathe in and let go of anything that we might be clinging to. Breathe out. We are resting, relaxing, allowing a spaciousness of the mind. Happiness in the mind. We can notice what qualities arise, maybe loving kindness, kindness seems to be what fills in the space when we let go of everything else. So we appreciate everybody coming, and those of you who came in later after we all checked in, it's nice to see you there.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.